the Honorable the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Northern Natural Gas Company versus Conoco Incorporated from Midland County. Union Pacific Resources Company versus the 13th Court of Appeals, an original mandamus proceeding. And the Honorable David Brooks, Judge, and Dana Metter versus the 5th Court of Appeals, also an original mandamus proceeding. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for oral argument. The petitioner or relator may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of our court. We'll take a brief recess in between each argument, and we'll complete these arguments before the noon break. The arguments are being recorded by the clerk. If you desire to purchase a tape of the arguments, you may make application with the clerk of our court. Justice Hankinson is recused from the first matter. The court is now ready to hear argument from petitioner in Northern Natural Gas versus Conoco.
May it please the court, Mrs. Jean A. Cook will present argument for the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please this honorable court. Seated with me at council table is Dean Smith. And next to Dean Smith is Mrs. Deanne Noel. Mrs. Noel has worked with us on this case since it was tried in the trial court and will be assisting. This is a breach of contract case. The question before this court is, should the court engraft a duty of good faith on a services contract for the transportation and processing of natural gas? A service contract between two very sophisticated companies. The Court of Appeals, in its opinion, agreed that Northern complied with all the express terms of the contract. However, instead of rendering, the Court of Appeals remanded to the trial court on the question of whether or not there was a breach of a supposed duty of good faith. There is no good faith duty in a services contract like the TNP, but even if there were such a duty, there was no breach of the express terms. What I would like to do now is I want to go directly to the heart of the first question that is raised by the Court of Appeals. They said there was a duty, an implied duty, and they cited 1.203 of the Uniform Commercial Code. First of all, 1.203, in our opinion, is not a construction or interpretation section. Second, let me read to you exactly what 1.203 says. The obligation of good faith. Every contract or duty within this title imposes an obligation of good faith and its performance or enforcement. Apparently what Justice Larson did when she wrote this opinion and cited this section, she did not read the official comment to the Uniform Commercial Code on page 53 of the Black Statutes, which says, this section does not support an independent cause of action for failure to perform or enforce in good faith. Now, assume that you disagree with me that 1.203 does apply. Let me then take you to this particular question. What does good faith mean under Article 1.203 of the Uniform Commercial Code? If you go to the other section cited by Justice Larson, you see that 1.203 means honesty in fact. And the question then arises, what does honesty in fact mean? Well, this very court has answered that question in Lacerra Grain in 1984. And here's what honesty in fact means. Good faith is defined as honesty in fact in the conduct or transaction concerned. The test for good faith is the actual belief of the party in question, not the reasonableness of that belief. There's still no problem. And I'd like to go to another point that I think is significant. Conoco has never really ever argued that Article 1.203 applies. They're arguing 2.306, but they really don't argue 1.203. The Court of Appeals, to support their position that there is an implied duty of good faith, cites everyone to the case of Crim Truck versus Navistar. Only they only took one sentence from that particular case. What I wish the Court of Appeals would have done would have cited these two sentences from Crim Navistar. We have, however, specifically rejected the implication of a general duty of good faith and fair dealing in all contracts. In any event, a breach of this contractual duty of good faith and fair dealing gives rise only to a cause of action for breach of contract and does not give rise to an independent part cause of action. How did the Court of Appeals commit error? First, the common law does not impose a duty of good faith in a services contract. And I want to stress this particular point. This is not a sales transaction. Everyone agrees this is not a sales transaction. This is a services contract between two very sophisticated companies.
Mr. Cook, the record's really not very clear. It seems the parties have changed their positions from trial court to appellate court to here on this issue. Doesn't the agreement itself say the UCC in terms of interpreting and construction applies? I mean, whether it's a service contract or a sales contract, doesn't the contract itself say we're going to look to the UCC
No.
for interpretation instruction?
Ah, there you go. I agree with what you just said, Your Honor. First of all, I don't think you're going to find that Northern has changed its position. We intend to put on a chart very shortly that will show Conoco's change in position. But what the article says, this agreement shall be interpreted in accordance with the rules of construction and interpretation as set forth in the Texas Uniform Commercial Code. That is Article 1. That is Article 1 that deals with the rules of construction and interpretation. If you go, there are two subparts under the Uniform Commercial Code in Article 1. And the first of those deals with construction, subsection B deals with interpretation. You can't say that the rules of construction regarding Article 9 secure transactions will be used on this case. You can't say that the rules of construction regarding Article 3 commercial paper. And you can't say that the rules of construction regarding Article 2, because it is a sale, and this contract was never a sale, Your Honor.
So Article 1.203 does apply if it's considered an interpretation or construction contract.
Yes, Your Honor, it does if you consider that. And then we listed three further reasons why it would not, or why it would not change the result. And those were, for instance, Your Honor, that it talks about honesty and faith. It doesn't create a new cause of action. It's still part of breach of contract. Your Honor, perhaps this is where the confusion lies. We argue under the terms of the contract that 1.205 applies. We argue very, very strongly that 1.205 applies because that is the section of the Uniform Commercial Code that deals with custom and usages of the trade. And we thought it was very important. And let me at this point I'll digress for just a second and tell you exactly why it was important. We have two very large companies. When this contract was first initiated, it was in 1979 between Northern on one side and CRA, which is the predecessor of Conoco on the other. At trial, the two people who negotiated the contract for both sides were present. They put on Heasley Rook, who was their witness. When we wanted to cross-examine him about what was the intent of the parties, what happened at the time the contract was negotiated into, they stood up and objected and said, the Uniform Commercial Code does not apply to this case. We felt that 1205 is the most significant rule of construction regarding the contract. Heasley Rook testified out of the presence of the jury that when the parties entered into this contract, they knew there was no minimum quantity, that Conoco would process all of the gas which Northern purchased and received.
Is that true?
What?
Is that correct under the terms of the agreement, that Conoco would process all the gas that...
Which we purchased and received.
But at the time they entered the contract, he had a bunch of contracts?
Yes.
They were producing?
Yes.
What Chronicle wanted. And then you set out to systematically cancel all of the contracts and dry Chronicle up. And you're saying we had every right to do that?
Yes. The contract provides that we will use them and no one else to determine, they will process everything that we purchase and receive, Your Honor.
But you made a conscious decision to dry them up by canceling.
No, not to dry up Conoco.
No, but dry up the supply of gas that you were obligated under the long-term contract. Because if you didn't buy any, you weren't obligated to sell.
We were never obligated under long-term contract. We were only obligated to deliver to Conoco, which we did, that which we purchased and received. Let me go a little, give you another little bit of information that will help clear it up even more. The overwhelming majority of all of these contracts with our producers were take or pay. We never had an obligation to take that gas. Under a take or pay, we can't say that the tail wags the dog. These contracts that we are talking about were take or pay contracts. We had the right at any time to say we're not going to take the gas, we're going to pay for it. That was our right with our producers. To say that we had to ignore that contractual right and deliver it to Conoco is not what the agreement provides. We then put on our expert at the time, and our expert said, here's what was agreed. Conoco would have the exclusive right to get any gas that we purchased. And when they had that right, and we could not deliver to anyone else, we were guaranteed, we wanted a guarantor of someone who would clean the gas for us. They wanted the right that we couldn't ever change anyone else who would do it for us at a cheaper price. Now, Conoco today is attempting to come in and say 2.306 apply. First of all, during the trial of the case, and if I, let me point to this one thing here, this one chart, first of all. This court has never said that there was a common law duty of good faith in a services contract. If you start in 1983 with English versus Fisher, look in 1997 with Stewart Title, this court has been perfectly consistent in saying there is no duty of good faith in a contract, much less a services contract. I don't think, let me go real quickly. Would you please change the chart and let's look at Conoco's positions? Because I think since you raised this, Justice Enoch, I think it is interesting to look at Conoco's position. We have uniformly argued that 1205 applies to us. Here is from the record exactly what Conoco's position is. First, we do not claim good faith under the general provisions of the Uniform Commercial Code. Secondly, we do not take the position the UCC is available to the contract. And third, when I was arguing to the trial judge that we should have in 1.205 custom and usage, Mr. Jad Davis right here stood up and told the judge, this is not a Uniform Commercial Code case. That's what he told the judge. And today they're saying in their brief, throughout this litigation, Conoco has contended. That's not true. Article 2.306 does not apply. It deals with sales. This is not a sale. There has never been any passage of title. I'd like to go back right now for just a few minutes and give you some of this background that I think is so significant in this particular case. In 1985, because of things brought about through natural gas deregulation, Northern started reducing its supplies under its purchase contracts. In 1989, Conoco came in and did a due diligence study before they bought. At that time, we had reduced significant purchases of our natural gas. It was all in the records. Conoco, it was all there for Conoco to see.
You were being evasive in some of the requests. They asked about it. Why are we not getting the product we were getting before? And then you were evasive.
They knew by the time they purchased, we had significantly reduced it. All of that was on the records of CRA. They knew about it. Now,
you admit that you were not candid with Conoco in all your dealings?
Your Honor, there were some misunderstandings, but I do not believe that Northern was not candid with Conoco. Conoco knew. Conoco is not a mom-and-pop operation. They are a multi-billion-dollar corporation that knew exactly what it was purchasing. And I think I should point out, at the time Conoco came in, they weren't really relying that much on us. We only accounted for 10% of the gas they ran through there. And if you look at this contract, anytime Conoco didn't like it, they had a 120-day out provision. If at any time they felt it was unprofitable for Conoco, they could come in and give 120 days notice and walk away. There were plenty of safeguards for both parties. But they are asking this particular court, they are asking this court to legislate an Article 2.306 feature for a services contract. And I don't think this court wants to legislate. 2.306 is a gap filler provision. There is no such gap filler provision under the common law. And I don't think one should be legislated by this particular court. Take or pay. Remember, Conoco, it had gas contracts. It could have. It knew that the majority of our contracts were take or pay. How it could come into this court and suggest that when our contracts were take or pay, we should ignore them and continue to deliver the gas to them is not correct.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Jad Davis will present argument for respondent. Let's go ahead and put it up. Do you care if I put the board up?
May it please the court, my name is Jad Davis. I live in Midland, Texas. With me is Luke Ashley of Dallas, Texas, and we represent Conoco. The representative for Conoco today is Mr. Rick Harrington, the general counsel of Conoco. Texas is the largest producer of natural gas in the United States. It's a unique product. It's a vapor. It's not a widget. From the wellhead to the burner tip, billions of dollars of capital investment are made to move that vapor from the wellhead to the ultimate consumer.
But you agree that all you were providing was a service.
Absolutely. Let me address this. I know that a service contract does not fall within Article 2 of the Uniform Commercial Code. And I've told the trial court that. I've told anybody that'll listen that I know that. We don't have a dispute on that. But we do have a choice of law provision in this particular contract that says the laws of the state of Texas will apply in the general terms on page 43, and it shall be interpreted in accordance with the rules of construction and interpretation set forth in the Texas Uniform Commercial Code. Now, to me, that means the parties have contracted to treat this as though it was a sale.
Mr. Cook argues that there's a specific article, Article 1, that talks about rules and construction, and that's all that's referencing.
If he's correct, and even if he is, there's a 100-year line of precedent, almost a 100-year line of precedent from this court on common law output and requirements contracts that have nothing to do with English versus Fisher, the tort duties of good faith and fair dealing, or any of this stuff on good faith that the petitioner argues. We embrace every case in that board.
In that regard, you have argued that this is an outputs or requirements contract. Is Conoco required to take all the gas that Northern provides?
Yes, subject to its capacity. And if the delivery under the specific term exceeds the capacity, then we have the option but not the obligation to build and expand our capacity, which occurred in this case by the addition of additional plants and almost 900 miles of gathering lines.
It's, well, specifically it says it agrees to buy all the gas to the extent it has sufficient pipeline capacity, but it's under no obligation whatsoever to increase that capacity at any time to accept all the gas that Northern sends it.
Except for this, if it doesn't increase its capacity to take that gas and it's dedicated to this agreement, then we suffer a detriment because Northern is free to contract with other parties to take and process that gas. And factually, in this case, there's not one lick of evidence that each and every time we dedicated additional wells, almost 400, 51 amendments, we expanded our capacity. We built lines out to the wellheads to take the gas.
But, of course, Conoco is not trapped into a requirement to accept all the gas. I mean, Northern can't force Conoco to take any more gas than Conoco has the capacity to accept under this agreement.
That's correct. And our plan.
And is there any agreement that Conoco, is there anything in the agreement where Conoco can dictate to Northern how much gas Northern must give to Conoco other than whatever gas Northern buys?
I think there are three express provisions that were breached. And the handout that Mr. Cook has given gives you all three of them.
Why isn't this simply an exclusive service contract? I've got gas I want serviced, and I just promise to let you be the person who provides the service on the. Why isn't that all this is, just an exclusive service agreement?
The output-type nature of this agreement is absolutely consistent with the common law kind of cases such as Portland Gasoline that I've handed out to the court, which is a 1951 service case in which Superior Marketing agreed to act as the seller of Portland's gas plant output. They rendered a marketing service. And at the common law in Portland Gasoline and Texas Industries, the Fifth Circuit case, which I've also handed out, those cases from 1950 say that even if it is a service contract, the same principles of mutuality apply. That's what the issue is. Why did we sue them? I told my son, I was coming down here and said, you the sewer or the defender? I said, I'm the sewer. He said, why'd you sue them? We sued them because they didn't deliver the gas.
What obligation did they have to deliver the gas?
There are three express.
Well, let's go over them.
And one in flight. Article 2, delivery of gas. Northern will deliver to CRA, and CRA will accept from Northern all the gas which Northern purchases and receives in accordance with Northern's gas purchase contracts with producers.
So if they don't purchase and receive any gas, they're not obligated to sell you anything. Under that provision.
No.
No?
If they go out and destroy the contract, how are they acting in accordance with their gas contracts with producers?
What if they just amended it, lowered the volume? There was still some gas, but they amended the contract.
With the, if they amended for partial takes, if they amended that factually, I mean, that would be an interesting question if they did it in good faith. They're fine.
Well, they did it because economically they felt their survival was better. What if they just lowered the take obligation so they had maybe a fraction of what they previously delivered to under these contracts?
The force, if they did it for economic reasons, the force majeure clause of this contract specifically provides that economic reasons shall not be an excuse for non-performance under the agreement.
Don't talk about, in their, they with their producers amended their gas purchase agreement to reduce the take line so that correspondingly the volumes they delivered to you were drastically reduced, but there were still some gas. Did they have the right to do that or not?
I think they've got the right to recontract for gas. I think they've got the right to purchased it in accordance with their gas purchase contracts and require us to process it under these three express terms. But factually, that's not what happened. They set out in bad faith and destroyed the subject matter of the contract such that they now claim we have no duty to deliver gas, and if they have no duty to deliver gas, we don't even have a contract.
Would it be bad faith for them to have decided to pay rather than take the gas?
You know, that is an interesting question, and it's a question that I've thought a lot about.
Isn't that the question really in this case? The argument of Northern is we bought out all the take or pay. In essence, we paid for not taking the gas, and the other side agreed and end of purchase agreement, and there we are. And you're arguing, no, they still had to take the gas.
What I'm arguing is this. We had, they had almost 60 gas purchase agreements that they bought out. There were three of them that had 80% of the volume. The UPRC, the Heasley-Rook, and the Parker Parsley contract. The greatest percentage of the volume was not under the take-or-pay type contract. It was a market risk, fixed price, where the market went the other way and they bailed out. And factually, if they continued to pay instead of take, I think that would be a case that we could discuss. But in this case, they neither took nor paid nor anything in accordance with the contract. They destroyed their subject matter.
But they have a right to do that.
I say they don't for three.
Well, show me where. I mean, what obligation to purchase any amount of gas?
Deliver these three provisions. Deliver
well,
your
gas. You quoted these three provisions. I'm looking at them. That can help me understand your argument.
Okay. My argument under processing. Northern exclusively contracts with CRA to process gas reserves purchased and received by Northern, which Northern is entitled to recover.
Is that purchase and receive?
The gas that they are entitled
to anything, they don't know. They're not obligated under what you're showing me to do either.
The argument being made by Northern is if we don't purchase, then we don't have to deliver.
That's right.
And basically, there is the line of cases, the Portland gasoline case, that implies a duty in an output contract. If we have a duty to process what they do purchase.
That's the key. Is that the key? What they do purchase.
If we have a, no, if we have a duty to process the gas, there's a correlative and reciprocal mutual obligation. Under the long line of cases, the Holquin, the Texas Gas, the Texas Industry versus Brown, the Portland versus Superior Marketing case, that a reciprocal mutual obligation to deliver the subject matter in good faith.
But if there's no subject matter, what are they to deliver?
Gas.
Well, they didn't purchase any gas. If they receive any gas, what obligation to purchase and receive it? That's what I'm asking.
Okay. In the agreement, the delivery says in accordance with their gas purchase contracts. Now, we know they didn't purchase the gas in accordance with their contracts.
They canceled them.
They canceled them.
That's right.
Second, which they're entitled to recover. And they dedicated that gas to this agreement, which they're entitled to recover under the gas purchase contract. They didn't deliver what they were entitled to recover. They canceled them. The third one, in keeping with the quantity and other provisions of the gas purchase contract, they didn't keep in accordance with the quantity of the, provided in the gas purchase contracts. They destroyed them. They torpedoed them. They have the right. Their argument has never been we couldn't get the gas. Their argument has always been we don't have to get it. And if that's the case, we don't have a contract.
What about the last six words?
Because it's illusory.
It's illusory.
What about the last six words of the quantity provision?
In quantity, in keeping with the quantity and other provisions of the gas purchase contract in effect from time to time, the term provision, Article 19, clearly contemplates that there will be multiple gas purchase contracts during the course of this agreement. The term is for a period for so long as various gas purchase contracts remain in effect, but not less than 20 years. I mean, the volume went to zero in 1994. We still got 5 years left.
Mr. Davis, let me ask, is it your position that anyone that I sell product and I agree to let ABC Corporation service my product exclusively. ABC, you can service my product exclusively. Here's the agreement. You have the exclusive right to service my product. And any time that I manufacture my product, you have the exclusive right. Is it your view that under an exclusive right to service contract, it then binds the party who's asking for the service to stay in the business of manufacturing that product for the life of the exclusive service agreement? Is Northern bound by this exclusive service agreement to stay in the business of natural gas purchasing?
I think that exact question was raised in the 1955 case of Texas Industries versus Brown, Fifth Circuit, United States Court of Appeal, 1955. And this is what they said.
Can you tell us what page you're on?
Yes, Your Honor. On page 512. What you have here was an aggregate plan. And this was a sale. Portland is a service. You had an aggregate plan. Three aggregate plants. And the seller of the aggregate to make these concrete blocks in Abilene, Texas, agreed to supply all the requirements. Well, the plants quit having requirements and said, by the way, don't send us any more aggregate. And following the Portland gasoline case from 1951, and these are pre-UCC cases, under Head Note 4, the requirements was the aggregate. That's the subject matter of the contract on page 4. In these circumstances, the law in Texas imposes an implied obligation upon the buyers to keep the plants in operation. Least by disposing of them or shutting them down, the buyers be permitted to destroy the subject matter of the contract. The requirements of the plants in violation of the intention of the parties that sales would continue for the full term thereof. The rule was recognized in the decision of the Supreme Court of Texas in 1951.
Of course, that's a sale, and then, of course, your good faith under 2.306 would apply, and so under the current state of the law, it would appear that if it's a good faith change in those circumstances, then that would govern.
I think that's correct, but the Portland case they cite from this court in 1951 is a services contract that applies this reciprocal mutual obligation. The rationale is this. If we have a duty to process, they have a correlative duty and mutually reciprocal duty so that the contract is not illusory to provide the subject matter.
For at least 20 years.
For at least 20 years, and then in 1984, the term was amended.
But you had an opt-out on 120 days notice.
No.
No?
And there's a stiff penalty. Under that provision, if our plant becomes uneconomic, we can say, okay, it's uneconomic. But we suffer a severe penalty. We have got to sell them our plant at the then market value. What's the market value of an uneconomic plant? Basically, we have to give them our $130 million asset. If it becomes uneconomic to operate the plant, and we want to invoke the provision.
If the reserves are depleted 10 years out before the end of the contract, nor the natural obligated to go out and sign up more contracts?
No. If those wells go dry, they can't deliver that gas in good faith.
But I thought under your theory, they're obligated to stay in business. And to do that, they have to go out and do that purchase.
Well, the dedications in the 51 amendments dedicate gas from specific acreage and wells. And if that acreage, if those wells don't produce the subject matter, then I don't think they've got any obligation to sign up additional gas volume. We're asking the court to follow Texas Industries versus Brown. We're asking the court to follow the Portland Gasoline versus Superior Marketing. We embrace the modern decisions of this court on tort duties. This is an action totally ex contracte. We embrace English versus Fisher. We don't want to import from California some covenant of good faith in every contract. But output and requirements type contracts at common law have been recognized forever.
Do you think it's still a requirements and outputs contract when Conoco doesn't have to accept all the gas that Northern purchases, except to the extent it has sufficient capacity at the time it entered into this agreement?
Yes, I do. I don't see that that distinguishes it. For this reason, as you dedicate, you build, you have to, because it is a unique product in a vapor, you have to build a line out to it, pick it up. You have to install compressors, pick it up. So the amendments, each time an amendment is made, you have to invest significant capital dollars to go get the vapor.
But doesn't the agreement specifically provide that Conoco doesn't have to do that? In fact, doesn't it say that Northern could do it or Conoco could do it, but no requirement that either one has to do it? Unless the line's attached, Conoco doesn't have to process it, and Conoco doesn't have to build the line, nor is Northern required to build the line either.
But what that is, Your Honor, respectfully, what that's talking about, at any given point, you have a certain volume and number of wells under contract. And this, to add additionals, you have to amend the agreement. So additional amendments to take in additional gas from additional wells on additional acreage are brought into the contract by specific amendments.
That may be so, but if they don't have that specific amendment, the agreement specifically says neither Conoco nor Northern have to build a line.
Either can, neither has to, until if they're not added and connected. That's correct. In conclusion...
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Cook, help me with a question that I have. Why is the Northern obligated to continue to purchase the gas in the various contracts from a dedicated well as long as those wells are productive for at least 20 years?
First, Your Honor, most of those contracts were take-or-pay contracts. It had the choice of doing it either way, and what it did was simply pay and get out of it permanently.
He had an agreement. He had an agreement with Conoco. As long as his dedicated wells were productive, you were going to buy the gas and allow it to be shipped to Conoco's pipeline. Why is that not true, that you had that obligation for 20 years?
We had the obligation.
Unless the contract was modified or terminated.
For 20 years.
Under provisions of the contract.
For 20 years, Your Honor, we had the obligation exclusively to deliver only to Conoco that which we purchased in.
From the dedicated wells, as long as those wells are productive.
From the various gas purchase contracts in effect from time to time. And that...
But then you had a bunch of dedicated wells.
That's right, Your Honor. And we never once took gas that we got from the dedicated wells and delivered it to anyone else.
Yeah, but you instead of continuing to buy for 20 years, you started casting those contracts or buying out. So you would not have to purchase...
Let me give you an analogy that perhaps will help. Assume that I'm buying cars from South Korea and importing them to sell in the United States. And the cars, when they come off the ship, are covered with dust and they're very dirty. So I take them to Conoco's service station and say, guys, I'm bringing these cars in, and every car that I purchase and receive,
Will you wash it?
For the next 20 years.
For the next 20 years. Because of economic conditions in South Korea, I stopped buying, purchasing, and receiving cars.
But that's not how it happened here. We have dedicated wells that are productive.
The tail should not wag the dog. Conoco should not be able to tell me I have to continue buying cars from South Korea so that they can continue washing.
Well, Mr. Davis, what's the answer to Texas Industries?
Your Honor, Texas Industries is a 1955 Fifth Circuit case that has never been cited by a single Texas court. The whole question, first of all, secondly, it's a sales contract. This is not sales. This is services. And the main issue in it is defense of mutuality. And we have total mutuality in our
counsel, case. For Conoco says that the Texas Industries is based on Portland, which is this court's case that does involve a service contract.
And Portland is a 1951 case, and the sole issue in Portland is mutuality. And let me, can I address mutuality?
Well, yes, he has.
Okay. Let me go back to Justice Owens. She said, isn't there a walk-away provision for Conoco? And Mr. Davis said, yes, but it's a terrible penalty. It would make us sell our $130 million plant if we walked away. Just so we can keep the record straight, please refer to page 13, Article 8, the termination provision of this contract. And it says, with 120 days' notice, they can terminate this agreement. In such event, Northern shall have the right, but not the obligation, to purchase the gathering facilities. That's the pipes that lead up to each well. This agreement never once said they had to sell their $130 million plant. That's not in the agreement. I think Mr. Davis just didn't think before he spoke. Mutuality has come up about four times, and I'm going to address it very quickly. Mutuality is the same thing as consideration. Consideration is benefit to the promisor or detriment to the promisee. Detriment under the law in this state is the surrender of a legal right or the assuming of a legal burden. The common example used in law school is you tell your nephew, stop smoking for a year, at the end of the year I'll pay you $100. He does, he wants his $100, you say, no consideration, no mutuality. But remember, the definition is surrender of a legal right or assuming of a legal burden. We agreed that we would never sell to anyone else. We never did.
Any other questions? Thank you.
That concludes the argument in the first clause.